I want to try to tie together two passages that, you know, maybe they kind of go together, kind of, maybe the connection isn't real clear. And that's Matthew 18 and Romans 14. Okay. But I want to start actually with a story that I think you're familiar with that was read about Joseph, one of the sons of Jacob. You know the story about Joseph, I think. He got sold as a slave by his own brothers because they didn't like him. They thought that he was snobby, I think. You know, his father liked him best, seemed like he was one of the favorite sons. He told him he had dreams that he was going to be a big shot and they were going to bow down to him. And they just didn't like him. They just didn't like him. So after he gets sold as a slave, he gets there and he does get to be a big shot, second in command in all of Egypt, the most powerful nation on earth at the time. And then his brothers come, and of course the brothers find out that he's still alive, that though they sold him as a slave, he's there and he's the boss, and they're afraid of him still. And I'm guessing they're still harboring some guilt about it. You got a guy who's second in command in the greatest nation on earth. He can do with them whatever he wants. Okay? So they concoct a little story after their father dies, and he says, they say to him, you know, your father, it was interesting. Your father told us, or wanted us to tell you, make sure you forgive your brothers. And so Joseph is a little bit moved by that. At least it seems that he is. But he says something to them that is the key to, I think, what I'm trying to say today, or one of the keys. He says, am I in the place of God? And his implication is, how can I not forgive you? Forgiveness is something that is of the essence of who God is. And how can I not do that if God has used this to bring about good? And that's a very interesting statement. Because Joseph, in spite of the fact that he's a big shot, is really humbling himself before them and before God. And he speaks kindly to them, and he says, I'm going to do good things for you. This is the foundation upon which our entire theology of forgiveness rests. Somebody once said, to err is human, to forgive is divine. Interesting to think about that, isn't it? To err is human, but to forgive is divine. In Exodus chapter 34, I mentioned this a couple weeks ago, we know that God reveals himself to Moses on the mountain. And one of the things he reveals about himself is he's a God who forgives sins. A God of steadfast love who continues to forgive sins. So it's very much of the nature of God. And not only does this apply to the whole question of forgiveness, but it applies to our relationship within the community of believers, within our families, within our neighborhoods. It's at right at the core of just who we are. We are not in the place of God. God does certain things, and we are simply trying to imitate what he does. Let's begin our discussion this morning, if you will, in Matthew chapter 18, this parable of the unforgiving servant. And I think most of us are pretty familiar with it, but let's go through and point out some of the details here for us to kind of remember what's going on. The parable is actually prompted by a question. Peter's question. And Peter's question is actually prompted by what Jesus has said earlier in chapter 18 about if your brother sins against you. And, you know, you go to him, you talk to him, you kind of work it out, and then you forgive him. And Peter wants to know, though, all right, that's pretty good, but how many times do I have to do that? Do I have to keep on forgiving somebody? And I think, you know, that's such a human question, isn't it? We all feel like, yeah, I mean, that's enough of that. I shouldn't have to deal with that anymore. All right? And Peter implies, isn't there some limit to that? And we know Jesus' answer. Jesus answers with some numbers that really kind of represent infinity. It represents you have to keep on doing it. In fact, in Luke chapter 17 and verse 4, Jesus talks about that there. If somebody comes to you seven times in a single day, now I don't know whether I've ever had anybody come to me in a single day, seven times, I made a mistake, forgive me. I mean, I think if it's the same thing that the person did, I'd be pretty upset by number seven. I'd want to go, well, how many times are you going to keep doing this? Maybe I'd say that, but I'd still be bound, would I not, to say, I forgive you. That's what Jesus tells us. But it is so much of us, so much a part of our humanity to think, I'd sure like to limit how much I got to do that. Forgiveness becomes the centerpiece of Christian behavior. There's no question about it. And that's what prompts Jesus to tell the story of the unmerciful servant. That's where he comes out with this story. And it's, you know, the details are rather interesting here. One of the commentaries I read this week suggested that the amount of debt owed probably is kind of exaggerated. I mean, it's very unlikely that a servant would owe another servant that sum of money. But that's kind of the point that Jesus is trying to get across. Whether it's realistic, the fact is, he makes the debts so humongously different that one is forgiven and the other is not. I should say that a servant might owe a master. The amount is just outrageously big. And the master forgives him. Okay. The issue, obviously, is lack of mercy for a small debt versus the enormous amount of forgiveness for a large debt that was given. And of course, we know the story. Once the master who had forgiven the one servant finds out that he didn't forgive his fellow servant for what was a small amount, he gets him and says, come here. You're going back. That's enough. If you can't even do that little thing for your brother, I'm not doing it for you. Okay? And so he revokes the forgiveness because of the hardness of heart of the servant. And Jesus' concluding words here are quite strong. He says, so also my heavenly Father will do to every one of you if you do not forgive your brother from the heart. And it's interesting that he notes that particular phrase there, is it not? From the heart. Sometimes we forgive, but kind of grudgingly. And I'm well aware that some things are a little harder than others to forgive. And, you know, you have to be able to deal with that. It can take time. It doesn't happen necessarily overnight and right away. But we train ourselves to do those things, don't we? We learn to do those things. We learn to do those things because that's what Jesus tells us we need to learn to do. And why? Are we in the place of God? We're not in the place of God. We are trying to do what God tells us to do. And we remember his words as well. From the cross, which we didn't get to this morning, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Could I have done that? I don't know. I really don't know. I like to think I'm moving in that direction. And that's what I think Jesus wants us to do, to move in the direction of being a forgiving person. Well, let's turn over now to Romans chapter 14. The issues in Romans 14 are a little different, but there's a connection which I hope I can make clear to you as we go through here. I've always thought Romans 14, among the other things we've been doing in the last couple of weeks talking about Romans, is kind of more nuts and bolts of living within the community of believers. And I think that becomes very clear here, maybe more so as the issues that Paul is dealing with have to do with religious behavior or what they thought as a way of being religious. Certain things they would attach to, okay, if I do this, that's what my religious behavior is supposed to be, okay? And that's kind of all the way through the passage here. And yet, you know, there are some things about how we're supposed to handle that Paul really gets into some nuts and bolts of it. And I think that's what makes it very interesting. But again, I think there's a connection between what we've been saying in terms of forgiveness and what's happening here. But let's take a look at it. The issue, as I mentioned, what is the proper way of being religious? Okay? Now, Paul begins the passage by simply saying, as for those who are weak in the faith, welcome him, but not to quarrel over opinions. And I know part of the issue here is, okay, we confuse what's an opinion and what's true religious behavior. Or we confuse opinion with orthodoxy, orthodox belief, or what should be true doctrine. Okay? And we often cross the line, and those things get mixed up sometimes, and we confuse one with the other. All right? And Paul picks on a couple of issues here, and I think there has to be some wisdom and reflection for all of us on which things are and which things are not really true religious behavior. Paul obviously picks on a couple here that are not, and we have to deal with those. But the issue is, or at least the beginning point, accept him whose faith is weak. Don't get into quarrels, because you start quarreling with somebody whose faith is weak, you're probably going to lose them. They may lose their faith completely. And that's one thing that the church does not want to happen. You know, Jesus, I think it's Matthew, makes this statement about Jesus. It says, a smoldering wick he will not snuff out. Think about that. Our faith is like a fire. For most of us, it starts very small. Maybe as just a smoldering wick. We were watching... Does anybody here like Bear Grylls? I love this guy. I mean, he's out in the wilderness, and he's able to survive in some pretty amazing things. But he shows how to start fires in the wilderness, and he knows what can be lit, what can't be, you know. And he doesn't take matches, but he has a spark thing. But it always starts with a little smoldering. That's kind of like the way our faith is. And a person whose faith is weak, maybe it's still just smoldering a little bit. We want to blow on that some. We don't want to put it out. We don't want to douse it quickly. We don't want to blow too hard on it, because then it will go out. We want to kind of fan it into a flame. And somebody whose faith is weak, if you start getting into quarrels with them, they kind of don't know what to do with that. So we have to be cautious. That's what Paul is trying to say. Do not get into quarrels over matters of opinion. There are two issues at stake here. Paul talks about one of them. It's a matter of food. Some people like to eat only vegetables, and they think that's their religious duty. They think that's the way they're serving God, by eating only vegetables. And that's kind of an interesting one today, because so many more and more people are becoming vegetarians. Now, I know it's for health reasons, and yeah, I'm okay with that. It's not a religious reason. Let's keep that straight, okay? But some people can confuse that. There can be some pretty deep theological arguments of why you should be doing that, because it takes care of your body better. I don't even want to go into that. The fact is, that's one of the issues there. That's one of the issues. Theirs, for them, was a religious matter. Celebrating certain days was another matter. I mean, our religious world is replete with different kinds of celebrations. Okay? And Paul says, all right, one of you thinks one day is more important than another. Everybody, some other group says, well, all days are alike, so it really doesn't matter. And he's just saying, look, you got to be convinced in your own mind. People have fought over these things and many other things like that, have they not? Paul is telling them, don't. Don't get into fights over them. In fact, Paul doesn't really take sides here until he gets a little bit further on in this. But he still says, you know, be very careful about how you handle these things. But to me, it's what he says to them and how he kind of picks apart the different groups here and how he addresses himself to the different groups involved that I think is important. What he says to them, what's the foundation of his argument? That's the connection we're going to make. To the first group. One group says we can eat anything. Verse 2. Now, we tend to see this group, I think, as kind of emphasizing their freedoms, okay? They feel perhaps a little less restricted in the expression of their religious behavior. Now, they can say all they want, we know Jesus made all foods clean, you know, and that's their justification, and because they see the freedom that Christ has allowed for them. They are probably the ones, and I'm going to make a little guess here, they're probably the same group who esteem all days alike. They don't necessarily feel restricted by looking at one particular day, one particular feast, as more important than any other. Okay? And I think in verse 5 that may be the case. But there's a problem with this group. The problem with this group is, I think, what Paul says in verse 3. They tend to look down on those who see their religious behavior as more restrictive. We're the group that believes in freedom. We're smart. We know what Christ says. And so they kind of look down their nose on the people who feel like it should be a little more restricted than that. He says, let not the one who eats despise the one who abstains. Catch that word, despise. There's a way that we can be condescending to other people, isn't there? When we perhaps think about, well, they just don't really know any better. You know, maybe at least within ourselves, we kind of feel smarter. We kind of feel like we know better. Paul says, just, you know, guys, that's out. That's not the kind of attitude that you need to maintain. He says in verse 4, why do you pass judgment on another man's servant? Okay? That's one group. And maybe I'm stereotyping here a little bit and putting people, you know, too easily in one group or another. But the fact is, Paul seems to see that group in the discussion here. But he has also a second group. Or at least Paul's kind of putting them everybody into two groups here. The second group eats only vegetables. Okay? They probably see their religious practice in a more restrictive way than the other group does. I don't know whether we want to use the word liberal and conservative. I don't even like those words, at least in this context. That doesn't work real well because it's maybe we got too many other ideas involved in it. But let's just say they see their religion as more restrictive than the people who feel like it's okay to just eat whatever we want. My guess is also, verse 5, they're the ones who probably observe particular days. These days are really important for us. Maybe they were still some of the holdovers from their Jewish faith that they felt like it was still important to celebrate the Passover. If you remember, Paul even does some of that himself. He wants to get into Jerusalem at one point to celebrate the Passover. Well, he doesn't hold anybody else to do that. It was his tradition. All right. Their problem isn't so much condescension as much as judgment. They look at that other group and say, well, they're just not doing it right. They're wrong. And so Paul says to them, don't pass judgment on those who don't observe those restrictions. You see the groups we got here? To one group, don't look down on everybody else because you know better. The other group, don't pass judgment on the others because God has accepted them as well. So there's kind of two things going on here. Whereas the first group is condescending, the second group is judgmental. And again, did everybody fall neatly into either one of those two groups? Well, maybe not. Maybe not. But the connection is the powerful thing here, I think. And I just simply call it the God connection. And it's the same connection that Joseph saw. It's the same connection that Jesus tells us about forgiveness. And it's a connection with, are we in the place of God to pass judgment on or to look down on somebody else? In verses 6 through 12, follow with me here, we see that this is the connection. It's what God has done among us and in us. In verse 6, Paul says, each one honors God in his own way and gives thanks in his own way. That's in verse 6. The one who eats, eats in honor of the Lord, since he gives thanks to God. While the one who abstains, abstains in honor of the Lord and gives thanks to God. See, both are giving thanks. And Paul says they're both trying to honor God. The connection is how they serve God. In verse 7, Paul goes on to say, look, none of us are living just for ourselves. Talk about a God connection. You know, we're not living just for ourselves. We're living for God. And he goes on to say in verse 8, we live to the Lord, we die to the Lord. So not only do we live for God, we die to God or for God as well. And then he keeps going with this. Paul keeps kind of piling on the information here. And in verse 9, he says, look, Christ died for this. God's your connection. Christ is your connection. Don't forget that. And in verse 10, he says, why do you pass judgment on your brother, or why do you despise your brother? For we will all stand before the judgment seat of God. We're not the judges. God is the judge. We are simply trying to establish a community in a way that reflects the nature of God in all that we do. be it forgiveness, be it our not accepting one another for quarreling over opinions, you know, for our attempting to make the community more godlike. That's all we're trying to do. And if there are some people who have a little bit of religious habit that's different than us, we have to be patient and recognize there are some things not worth fighting over. Don't we do that in our families? Don't you think about choosing your battles carefully? You know, some things are just not worth arguing about. You know, if we prefer to avoid conflict, probably most of us anyway, but some things are worth conflicting about, some things are not. And so you choose your battles carefully, and you deal with those things, you deal with them in a way that's godly. What's the foundation for that? Number one, it's God. Number two, forgiveness. Forgiveness is the foundation for all of our relationships. If that's not there, I just don't know how a relationship is going to stay whole and be reflective of the nature of God. Verses 10 through 12, for it is written, actually 11 through 12, as I live, says the Lord, every knee shall bow to me and every tongue shall confess to God. So then each of us will give an account of himself to God. We all have to stand before God. And if, you know, our religious practice is a little different from somebody else, then maybe there's some of those things that aren't that important. So don't let them become barriers to you and other members of the community. You know, there's so many conclusions to draw here. Let's try to draw the big ones. Are we in the place of God to withhold forgiveness from anybody? Jesus tells us, no, we're not. Are we in the place of God when it comes to certain opinions of religious practice? Paul tells us, no, we're not. We must forgive like God forgives. And I think we also must, what Paul concludes here in verse 19 of this passage, pursue what makes for peace and for mutual upbuilding. How can I conclude this other than say that's the way we're supposed to live? Because that's the God connection. We are simply serving God, so continue to do so with forgiveness and with patience for one another. Floyd, shall we sing?